You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents...
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as The Daily Meditation Podcast, The Accidental Creative, and I Know What Scares You. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk. Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
This week, as was foretold in previous episodes, we're welcoming back Professor Chris French to discuss his long-awaited work, The Science of Weird Shit. Yes, I've had to slap an explicit label on this since we will be saying the word shit over and over again throughout this discussion. And I'm constitutionally unable to beep them all out. Plus, it feels like culturally we've come up with far worse things, which are everywhere, uncensored, while getting prudish about vulgar slang for something that we're all familiar with is perhaps missing the point. Anyway, I think it's a wonderful title, and I'm really enjoying reading it now that I have my hands on it, and I bet you will too. But let's go talk with Professor French about one of the chapters in his book and about how his field of anomalistic psychology engages with that topic of aliens and UFOs.
Monster Talk.
We're excited to welcome back Dr. Chris French to talk about his new book, which we teased in his last interview. This is The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. And Chris is the head of the Anomalistic Psychology Department at Goldsmiths University, London. Or you were when we last spoke, I think. But you're winding that down and going emeritus, is that right? Or
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I actually retired in 2020. And at the time, there was a kind of had a bit of a discussion about whether or not the anomalistic psychology research unit should continue. And we decided that, yeah, OK, it could. It didn't cost a lot to the college, you know. But I have actually now drawn a line under it, literally within the last couple of days. Because what was happening was I would still be getting kind of queries from potential postgraduates saying, oh, I'd love to come and do a PhD in that area. And I had to write back and say, well, actually, I retired. I'm not taking on any more postgraduates. And so it was a bit just, you know, it was a bit of a shame to keep just having to disappoint people. So I'm going to carry on doing stuff, carry on doing research, carry on writing, et cetera, et cetera. It's just, it will no longer be under the auspices of the APRU. The APRU is an X unit. It has ceased. It has gone to meet its maker. There's no more APRU.
It's pining for the fjords.
It is.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your new book. I mean, obviously, I know about it because I was just looking at it. But tell the listeners about your new book.
Yeah, well, it's one that I've been meaning to write. I mean, I did a little speech at the book launch event that we held a few days ago. And so for that, I kind of looked back on the history of how it had come about. And it's kind of quite interesting because I realized that I'd written the proposal for it back in 2010. And then the day job just kept getting in the way. I couldn't actually move it forward. What then happened was that I did a Reddit Ask Me Anything session, which went very well. And I was contacted then by an agent from New York who said, have you ever thought about doing a popular science book on this stuff? And I wrote back saying, well, I put a proposal together a few years ago, but it'll be a bit out of date, but I can send it to you. I sent it to him and he really liked it. And then it was still several years before I was able to take it forward. But fortunately, he was still interested. It turned out he worked for basically the most successful literary agency in the world. So I thought, well, that's good.
Handy.
And he was the son of the owner of the most successful literary agency in the world. So I thought,
double handy.
I'm in safe hands here. So, and I met him a few days ago in the flesh for the first time, and he's a really nice guy. He got me a wonderful deal with MIT Press. And the rest, as they say, is history. So now I've finally got this book out, which is based on, you know, many years of research and even more years of interest in the area. And I can kind of bring in as many kind of funny stories to kind of hopefully try and make it an engaging read as well. Yeah. And now we'll see how it does.
Yeah, it absolutely is an engaging reading and certainly a long time in the making, as well as you've just explained.
Yeah.
But you use the phrase anomalous psychology. Could you explain that for our audience?
Sure. Yeah. Anomalistic psychology is the phrase I use. But again, you know, it's basically, you know, it is the science of weird stuff. So it's primary aim is to see if we can develop and wherever possible test non-paranormal explanations for ostensibly paranormal experiences, and also kind of look into the psychology of related beliefs. So it's very much takes a skeptical approach to the paranormal. As many people know, I used to believe in a lot of paranormal stuff, and then I became a skeptic. So it's everything from kind of alien abduction claims to people who think they've got psychic powers, people who think they've seen a ghost, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Trying to see if we can explain these things in conventional scientific and psychological terms.
Karen and I have kind of been playing around with the language a little bit because the skepticism tends to automatically start dividing people into believers and non-believers. And I was pleased to see you address that concept in the text. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. I think I've come down on pro-reality activist right now. I don't think it's a great banner, but it sort of defines what I do.
Well, it's just so difficult to come up with a term, isn't it? I mean, that was the problem that I had when people used to say to me, you know, what's your area of research? And I would come out with, oh, well, it's the psychology of ostensibly paranormal experiences and paranormal beliefs, which is a bit of a mouthful. And so I decided I wanted something a bit more concise. And I didn't coin the term anomalistic psychology. It was already out there, but I thought that's the term. So then when people said, what's your area of research? I could say anomalistic psychology. And of course, they'd immediately say, what the hell is anomalistic psychology?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the psychology of ostensibly paranormal experiences and related beliefs. So it didn't really solve the problem. But I think a few more people now are aware. It is a term that, yeah, I think we've managed to kind of got some traction with it. I think more people, still very a lot, most people don't know what it means, but more people do know what it means.
Well, would
right,
you be...
although I'll call you a professional skeptic.
yeah. Well,
I get that one a lot.
I'm happy with that. But I mean, again, it's kind of interesting because I quite often, even now, will be introduced as a parapsychologist, and I immediately say, well, no, I'm not. I'm not a parapsychologist. I'm a psychologist with an interest in the paranormal. But I'm first and foremost a psychologist.
It's funny how much labels are important to help sort of frame things for people, but yet can become, you know, this stumbling block for being understood as well. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, the book is full of interesting paranormal, supernatural type topics, but they're all framed within this anomalistic psychology approach to the material. So we're going to be talking about aliens today, and that's what this chapter that we looked at is about. And of course, in order to tell that story, there's a historical content that has to be dealt with. And then there is, you know, how do these things play out with human perception? But let's start with what I think of as sort of ground zero, which is Kenneth Arnold's flying saucer, which kind of kicked off all this stuff. What psychological effects are at play in the story of Kenneth Arnold and the flying saucer?
Well, again, I mean, that's what happened there was that Kenneth Arnold was flying his private plane near the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. He saw he reported back that he had seen, I think it was 9 craft doing amazing maneuvers, flying at amazing speeds beyond anything that he, you know, thought was possible. And when he landed, he reported this to the press, and there was a great interest in it. One of the interesting things is that he didn't describe the craft that he saw as being saucer-shaped. The saucer connotations came when he was talking about the movement of the craft. He said it was like someone skimming a saucer, you know, across a lake or across water, that kind of bouncing motion. But the press loved the phrase flying saucer. And it was interesting that after that, people tended to see saucers, you know, it's a kind of nice of top-down processing, the role of expectation. Yes. But one of the general comments to be made about close encounters of the first kind, as that would count, would be the fact that up in the air, there are no cues to size, speed and distance, not like on the land, on the ground. And so people will often kind of make these assertions about it was so big, it was flying at such and such a speed and it was so far away. The retinal image is the same for a small object that's close to you moving fairly slowly as a large object that's far away moving fast. And so I don't doubt Kenneth Arnold's sincerity. I think he genuinely did see something and he didn't know what it was, and nobody's ever really conclusively explained what it was. There have been suggestions, but that was the thing that got the whole ball rolling, you know. And it was after obviously it was about the same time as Roswell, so that happened in the same year. So it led to a kind of series of what were called UFO flaps, where lots of people were reporting seeing these objects. Now, one of the really interesting things for me is that obviously there's a lot of interest from the media, from the press, and there were public opinion surveys at the time asking people what they thought, what was causing these UFO flaps, what were these UFOs. But interestingly, at that point, ET hardly featured as an option. You know, whereas now people look up in the sky, they see something, they don't know what it is, and they automatically think ET. Back then, they didn't. It was the biggest worry was that it was Soviet military technology. But the other options were, you know, some meteorological phenomenon or weather balloons or whatever else it may be. And yet now, as I say, we automatically make that leap from something up in the sky, we don't know what it is, to ET. And that's a huge inferential leap. And yet most people make it very, very readily.
Does anomalous psychology have anything to say about the wave of popular interest that swept through the English-speaking world after this? Because, I mean, it really blew up.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think the whole the psychology and sociology of almost what we would once have called kind of mass hysteria, those kind of, you know, situations where an idea spreads throughout a population, causes great excitement, and, you know, everybody's very, very interested. The whole, you know, that happens in lots of other ways as well, you know, as we're aware. You can get, it doesn't seem on the surface to be that close to things like satanic panics and so on, but it is. It's the same kind of thing, a contagion where an idea catches on and then, you know, people kind of latch onto it. I mean, again, we're talking in all of these cases only about a kind of minority of the population, but enough of people to make it something that kind of, yeah, okay, gains traction in the media. These things are reported, that amplifies it, and so on and so forth. So, and again, we know that media interest, or even whatever the latest big hit on TV is, will actually influence these kinds of things to some extent. I mean, these beliefs tend to always be there, whether we're talking UFOs, ghosts, whatever. But they are influenced. I mean, when Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, we saw a big spike in UFO sightings, you know, partly because it was on people's minds. They were looking up in the sky. People want to be part of it as well, which I can quite understand. I mean, when I was a teenager, well, even now, to be honest, I'd be really excited if I saw a UFO in the sense of something up in there in the sky and I don't know what it is, you know. But when I was a teenager, you know, the idea of seeing a flying saucer, that would have been so cool. I really wanted to do that, you know. So it probably wouldn't have taken much for me, you know, to have misidentified some Chinese lanterns or whatever and tell everybody I'd seen a flying saucer, I'd seen a UFO.
Well, Chris, speaking about the latest thing in UFOs, do you think that there are parallels for the renewed interest in so-called UAPs?
Oh, God, yeah. I'm not going to call them UAPs. There's nothing wrong with the term UFOs. It's perfectly accurate description. I mean, again, I suspect I probably share your view on this. It was such a fuss about nothing, wasn't it, really? Mm-hmm. I mean, you kind of had no actual new evidence being presented, just it was the same people that had been saying the same thing for years and years, and they'd got the ear of some senators and so on, and so there were questions being asked in the Congress, and then the press would kind of misreport it to some extent, almost as if the American government had now acknowledged that ET was real, which, of course, you looked at the wording of what the statements that were being made, and they were much more careful than that. And then the latest report from the AARO, which poured cold water on all of it, you know. And and I wasn't surprised by that, but
I was delighted. I was delighted to see confirmation from that everything we've been saying was accurate.
Yep. Ugh. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I was in a debate only last week, in fact, at the University of Southampton with an abductee. Really nice guy. We got on very, very well. He's totally sincere. He's obviously had some weird experience in his life that he thinks this is the best explanation for. But the timing of the AARO report was superb from my point of view, obviously. This is not me saying it. This is somebody who had access to all of the evidence. You know, this is, I mean, and again, it was no great surprise, but it was, as you say, it was very, very welcome to hear that. Of course, I've just been reading an article in The Guardian, actually, saying that he's now kind of, surprisingly, the author of that report is now receiving death threats and et cetera, you know.
Right. Well, that passes into the, how is this like a religion? And it's a lot like a religion. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And that is a point that he has made himself, you know. I mean, we knew there were only ever kind of two possibilities. Either a report would come out that said, yes, we found ET, and in which case it would have been welcomed by the ufologists with open arms. Or if it didn't say that, well, it's all part of the cover-up, it's all part of the conspiracy. Right. Despite the fact that we're talking about someone who had total security access to any piece of evidence he wanted to look at.
Well, there's two big encounter cases that you discuss in this chapter, and they are Roswell and the Rendlesham Forest case. And I know we've talked about them several times on the show, but in the off chance that some listener who doesn't know anything about this topic hops in and was like, what are they talking about? Could you give a little overview of those two cases?
Yeah, well, Roswell was an interesting one because it came out that, you know, it happened not long after the phrase flying saucer had entered the language. And it was reported that the USAF said, we've captured one of these flying discs, you know. So they basically were saying, we've caught a flying saucer. We've got a flying saucer. Now, the debris that was found was basically, well, if you look at the original descriptions, it is exactly what we now know it was. It was a balloon. It wasn't just an ordinary weather balloon, but it was a balloon. It was sticks, tin foiled, kind of, you know, just the kind of stuff that would make a weather balloon. Now, I think the situation there, it was very, very quickly announced that, oh, it wasn't one of the flying discs. It was a weather balloon. And there were photographs, you know, showing people with the debris to support that. But it wasn't until a few decades later that Stanton Friedman in particular kind of made out there was more to this. And basically the myth arose that it was a crashed UFO, crashed flying saucer. Then there were various books came out, all telling kind of somewhat different stories. But basically the idea was that there had been a flying saucer that had crashed. And in some cases it was claimed that alien bodies had been recovered and so on and so forth. All built on a lot of nothing, really. But there were also eyewitnesses that were coming forward who were saying, oh, yeah, we saw the alien bodies and blah, blah, blah. And I remember watching a documentary long after I'd kind of become a kind of card-carrying skeptic, which I was actually kind of thinking, gosh, you know, the evidence is much stronger. And then chasing up on it and reading one or two books. Cal Korf has got a very good book on this, and Philip Klass. And realizing that actually no, it's that there is nothing to this. Well, there is. Sir. Let me correct that. It turned out the official story, and I think it's the correct explanation, was that the debris that had been found was from Project Mogul, which was a secret military project where they were sending balloons up to see if they could pick up on sonar energy from Soviet nuclear testing. And I mean, again, this is something that's happened maybe a bit too much in the past, where the military have preferred that they don't want to reveal they're doing the secret testing. That's understandable, but that kind of so there is a cover up, but it's not the cover up that the ufologists think is there.
Right.
It's just that they are not letting on what they're really doing.
It turns out we're not all entitled to national security secrets.
Apparently not. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it, eh?
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
There is so much in our universe that remains hidden. Until now. My name is Kristen Seavey, and I have some stories that you might want to hear on the podcast, The Hidden Staircase. Whether it's true crime, paranormal occurrences, or perhaps something beyond the stars, I keep all their stories safe in my library. So come with me down the staircase. Pull up a chair and let's discover the enigmas that remain hidden from us all. Listen to The Hidden Staircase now, wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah. Chris, how important is an understanding of how human memory, human perception, and cognitive bias actually work to understanding these evolving narratives?
I think it's hugely important. It's hugely important. I mean, again, it was sticking with the topic of UFOs, even at a very basic level. We know that, I mean, perception is a constructive process, as is memory. And so we often don't realize to what extent we are filling in the gaps. I mean, it feels, you know, I'm sitting here now in front of my laptop talking to you guys, and it feels as if I'm getting a pretty much full 3D picture of my surroundings and so on in full color. You know, even that's not true, because it's only the very center of your retina that has color sensitive cells. The rest of it's been filled in by your very, very clever brain. But of course, it means that because it is this constructive process, sometimes we can end up making mistakes and kind of seeing things that aren't there. In particular, I mentioned earlier this concept of top-down processing, the way that your own beliefs and expectations and knowledge about the world can actually have an influence, particularly in less than perfect observational conditions. So again, typically you see UFOs at night up in the sky, as I said before, no cues to depth, no cues to distance. And if you think that what you're seeing is some kind of flying saucer, you know, we've got reports where people have added in all kinds of details. You know, they had windows, they could see little alien faces looking back at them and so on. And yet we've figured it out. Oh no, actually it was the planet Venus. You know, I mean, it's it sounds ridiculous, but we do know it happens. And it can happen to professional pilots, to astronomers, to, you know, it can happen to a whole range of people. Just because you are professionally trained in some way does not mean you can't make these errors. We all can.
Yeah, I think about that. It's not you can be trained out of experiencing those gaps, but you can be trained to recognize that they exist and therefore consider that as a possible explanation.
That's right.
That's a hard lesson, especially for people who don't actually want to learn it.
Just to answer Karen's point about memory as well. I mean, we know that it's not just what's happening when you are witnessing an event, but also what happens afterwards can influence your memory. And again, most people, I mean, a surprising percentage of people still think that memory works like a video camera, recording every detail of everything you experience. And of course, it just doesn't, you know. But that also leads to lots and lots of errors. You know, people report that the incredible detail of something that they believe they've witnessed, even if it was years and years ago. And yeah, it's very likely that there's going to be memory distortion there.
So I have a hard question here, or I think it might be interesting. It was hard for me to write it exactly because I want to ask about psychological differences in people who claim to have had alien contact, but I don't want to try to pathologize them. I'm just wondering if they share personality traits, or is there anything clinically distinguishable about a person who reports or believes that they've had like firsthand exposure to aliens versus people who believe in them but don't claim to have been visited by them?
Yes, there has been quite a lot of research looking at that because, I mean, again, a very uninformed, skeptical position. I used to have one of my postgrads who was a great lad, but he wasn't working in this area, and he kind of would look at me, give me strange looks, and kind of just say, "They're all nutters." Mm. Now, this is not an explanation, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous, but that was his attitude. And it's the attitude of a lot of people now. There's actually been quite a lot of research carried out by both people who do support the ET hypothesis and skeptics who don't support the ET hypothesis, comparing groups of abductees, experiencers, whatever you want to call them, and control samples, people who don't believe they've ever been abducted. And in general, there are not higher levels of serious psychopathology in the experiencers. Having said that, there are some kind of noticeable differences. For example, you find that those kind of people tend to score higher on certain measures like schizotypy, which is basically a kind of posh word for having unusual experiences. They score higher on measures of absorption, which is these are all things that kind of indicate like a very rich imagination. And they kind of fantasy proneness is another factor which has been looked at. To my mind, they have the kind of personality profile that would make them susceptible to false memories, and I think that is the most plausible explanation for what we've got. Most of these people are not, as I say, not suffering from any kind of serious psychopathology, but they're kind of they do differ in certain noticeable ways from the general population, and yeah, I think you can make quite a strong case that we are. I mean, the other factor when we're talking about false memories, of course, is that a lot of the details of, not always, but very, very often, the details of the abduction experience were the result of hypnotic regression. Because lots of people think that hypnotic regression is a reliable tool for uncovering hidden or repressed memories. The truth is, it actually provides the perfect context for the formation of false memories. And it's interesting that with hypnotic regression, you tend to get what you expect to get. So if you go for hypnotic regression with the suspicion that maybe you've been abducted by aliens, and we can talk about how you get that suspicion in a minute, but if you go with that, then there's a good chance that you may well end up apparently recovering detailed memories of exactly that experience. Mm-hmm. However, if you had gone expecting to find that you were George Washington in a past life, then that's what you'd get. If you go expecting to find evidence that you have been the victim of ritual satanic abuse, then that's what you'll get. In other words, you pretty much get what you expect. And so, yeah, that for me is very, very strongly indicative that we are almost certainly dealing with false memories. As I say, that explanation doesn't apply to all cases. There's no one size fits all.
Right, right.
Nation.
It's quite complicated. You said the phrase fantasy prone personality, and I've heard Robert Baker and Joe Nickel have talked about that before. And I did some research because I wanted to see what does that mean, but I couldn't find that it had a clear definition within psychology. Has that changed, or is that kind of a layman term? I didn't know.
There is a body of there are quite a lot of papers on it. I mean, quite a lot referred to in the book. If you want to chase up on some of the references,
Would. Yes, I'd love to shore that up. Absolutely, yeah.
But it was first coined by I think it was Wilson and Barber. They were interested in what are the psychological differences between people who are highly hypnotizable. You can measure hypnotic susceptibility in various kind of standardized ways. And they wanted to look at people who scored really, really highly on these scales compared to, the average person. And they found some very, very interesting differences. But overall, they kind of described these people as being basically fantasy prone, people who sometimes confused things that they imagined with things that had really happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the group that they studied, I think, as I recall, they were all females. And many of them, I mean, I think over half, if I recall, this is from memory, had phantom pregnancies. And again, that's relevant to the abduction stories as well, because of this notion that there's some kind of sinister crossbreeding experiment going on. They often reported that they themselves had psychic ability, that they were healers, that had numerous other ostensibly paranormal experiences. And again, it's not just, it can be, you can get cases where somebody's had no other weird stuff in their life at all, but then suddenly feel that they become convinced that they've had an experience of contact with aliens. But more likely than not, these people have had a lot of other ostensibly paranormal experiences before. They've seen ghosts, they hear voices, they're all sorts of stuff like that. So there's been quite a lot of research into fantasy proneness just in its own right, not necessarily as it relates to paranormal beliefs and paranormal experiences. Mm-hmm. There seem to be two main routes by which you can become a fantasy prone person. One is simply that you are brought up in a very creative household with very artistic parents who encourage you to play fantasy games and to do drama and, write stories and stuff like that. But the other route is basically people who've had a pretty unpleasant childhood.
Mm.
And it might be some form of abuse, or it might just be a long period of childhood illness. But it's almost as if they create this fantasy world as a kind of psychological defense and escape mechanism to escape from the harshness of reality. But then when they grow up, they are the kind of people who tend to, sometimes confuse imagination with reality, maybe prone to false memories and hallucinations and a whole range of other factors. But often, as I say, often very, very creative individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're talking about alien contact, and I think we should look at a couple of infamous cases of alleged contactees. So one of the stories that comes to mind for me is that of Betty and Barney Hill. So mm-hmm. Chris, could you tell us a little bit about what anomalistic psychology would make of their claims?
I think what's interesting about their claim, it wasn't the first, but it was the first to really capture the public imagination. And it almost kind of seemed to provide a template for other cases that were to follow. There were so many factors in there that then became kind of copied in other cases. So Betty and Barney were quite an unusual couple. They were an interracial marriage, which was quite unusual at the time. Both very intelligent people, kind of very politically engaged, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, they were driving home from a, I think it was a weekend away. They thought they saw a UFO up in the sky. Barney stopped the car to have a closer look, got his binoculars, and basically thought he was looking at some kind of alien craft. And they got back in the car and they kind of drove home. They later reported the kind of missing time experience. They couldn't figure out why it had taken them so long to get home. And initially that seemed to be pretty much it. But then later, Barney was seeing a psychiatrist, and he was talking about this experience. Basically, the other thing I missed out, sorry, was that Betty, after this event, started to have dreams, and in the dreams she was taken on board an alien spaceship. She was medically examined, and so on. Again, all these kind of things that became recurrent themes with these kinds of cases. A few years later, they were hypnotically regressed, and more details came out. And it looked basically the story that came out was that they had been basically stopped by these aliens, taken into the spaceship, both been medically examined. Betty had been shown a star map, which supposedly showed the routes that the aliens used, and this was later claimed to, you know, be something that did correspond to genuine stars. That was therefore proof, you know. Anyway, without going to the full details, other critics, critics of this case, it was written up by John Fuller in a book called The Interrupted Journey, which was a bestseller. He failed to mention that the psychiatrist who had done the hypnotic regression didn't believe it was that these things had really happened. He thought it was just fantasy. And a lot of the other details can be explained. Basically, it looked like it was the planet Jupiter that they'd first seen. It was very bright that night. It was in the right part of the sky at the right time. The missing time experience, they actually left the main highway because they were worried about this UFO. So they took a very circuitous route home. As I say, there was a lot of other detail there. I mean, I was, you know, trying to summarize the case. But they became convinced that they had this encounter with aliens. And I say it seemed in many ways to kind of set a kind of template that a lot of other subsequent cases followed.
Chris, could we talk about one more case, the Whitley Strieber case? That's one mm-hmm. that many skeptics know about and are curious about. So what can anomalistic psychology tell us about that particular case?
Well, Whitley Strieber was a very interesting case. I mean, Phil Klass had some really interesting insights, as always. But basically, he reported that he had been abducted by aliens. They'd kind of done all sorts of rather horrible things to him, you know, needles and what have you. There have been films made based on his story as well as his best-selling book. Very strong case can be made that we are dealing with somebody who is highly fantasy prone here. Not only was he a successful horror writer before he began to claim all of this stuff, but also if you look at his own description of his life, it is bizarre. He claimed he was attacked by a skeleton on a motorbike when he was a teenager, for example. By his own admission, he sometimes confused things that had really happened with things that hadn't. He had an obsession about kind of intruders. He used to, have all the windows, all the doors locked and look in all the cupboards and the wardrobes and so before he went to bed and so on. And certainly some of the descriptions that he gives sound just like classic cases of sleep paralysis. And I think that's what we've got there, basically. We've got somebody who was prone to these kinds of unusual experiences and in particular sleep paralysis. Also somebody who was, you know, a very good writer and no doubt really genuinely did believe that these experiences were real. I mean, his wife reported that, you know, he could see things that other people, including her, couldn't see. So, yeah, I mean, I would take everything there with a huge, huge pinch of salt. But it did generate such an increased interest in the whole phenomenon. You know, it was one of the major best-selling books around the world on this topic. That face of the alien, exactly. The gray alien, you know, that
oh yeah, that, very iconic.
Talk about, yeah, a culturally available template. That's
it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
It's now in cartoons. It's on T-shirts. It's in graffiti. Yeah. You know, that's mm-hmm. for most people, that's what an alien looks like. You know.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Now, I want to say a couple things here. You do call out several researchers that influenced your career. And I wanted to say, as a reader, how pleased I was to have met you, Richard Wiseman, and Susan Blackmore in real life. And you're like the psychological Scooby gang I'd most want to take with me on an investigation. That'd be
I got such a kick out of getting to meet people like James Randi and Ray Hyman and James Alcock. You know, it's James Alcock's book that turned me onto skepticism in the first place. And it was just such a kick to kind of meet them at kind of skeptics conferences. And then the more involved I got, you know, I mean, I got to the point where I kind of knew I was on hugging terms with James Randi, you know, and I still kind of take great pride in that, you know. Mm. And again, you know, other great people, you know, I can see looking back. I mean, now that I've retired, and particularly with writing the book, you look back and you can kind of think, well, okay, so who were the big influences? And again, I have to kind of nod to Sue Blackmore, obviously. I think, was it Bertrand Russell who said that the history of Western philosophy is like a series of footnotes to Plato? I think everything I've done in my career has been a series of footnotes to Sue Blackmore, you know. and then Richard Wiseman, you know, who is just such a great guy, such a character. Not that I'm jealous, you know, but I mean, he's so incredibly creative and witty. And I love him. I think he's
a joy to talk with. He's one of those quick-witted people where you just have to be on your toes. It's great.
Yeah,
it's really great.
Yeah. I don't try and compete. You know, I know I can't keep up with Richard, but I just enjoy his company so much. And I do make him laugh a few times. So
if people want to go back and listen to our interviews with Richard Wiseman, I think they're a treat. He's quite witty. Now,
you've probably read the foreword of my book, which Richard kindly wrote for me.
Oh, I did. Yes, exactly. It was fresh on my mind. Now, so normally, you know, we've done our Monster Talk signature question is, what's your favorite monster, which is a lighthearted way to end these interviews. I'm going to ask you something a little more serious. So it's been my conclusion after learning about the frailty of our perception and cognition in the face of ambiguity that we, as a species, shouldn't hold such confidence in our weird experiences. So how has learning this stuff affected you personally? And do you have any advice for people who want to trust their senses and decision-making, but are just learning about these confidence-shaking clinical findings about how perception and memory work?
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, I think the kind of one of the biggest take-home messages for me is, in terms of what evidence really, really do people find convincing, and most people, including many skeptics, it's personal experience. That trumps everything else. So, you know, the number of times I've heard skeptics say, well, I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen it. Therefore, they don't exist. Well, that's completely wrong, you know, insofar as just because you have never seen one doesn't mean they don't exist. You could experience a ghost, but that doesn't mean that they do exist, because we're all susceptible to these kinds of biases, to potential hallucinatory experiences like sleep paralysis, and to a whole host of other factors. So, you know, I don't think that people should have such great faith in their own personal experience. I mean, by and large, it serves us really, really well. And it's amazing the jobs that our cognitive systems do you know, every second of our waking lives without not even being consciously aware of most of what's taking place there. But there are these systematic biases. They affect perception, they affect memory, they affect reasoning, they affect all kinds of other cognitive processes. And I think being aware of that doesn't eliminate those biases, but it does maybe minimize them a little bit. We're all still prone to them, believers, skeptics, everybody. And therefore, I think it's best to try to be a little bit humble in terms of, you know, there's a lot we don't know. Even in the world of the paranormal, we cannot say, oh, we know that ghosts don't exist. We know that people aren't being abducted by aliens. If you want to know what I think, I don't think those things are happening. But I could be wrong. New evidence might come along that makes me change my mind on some of these topics. And you basically, I think all you can do is to say, well, at the moment, I believe this for these reasons. And, you know, you can either agree with me or you can disagree with me. That's fine. But being aware of the fact, so the number of people who say, you know, I'm a neutral assessor of the evidence. Nobody is a neutral assessor of the evidence. We all bring preconceptions. We might change our minds, as I have, but we the current state of us, we've got things that we believe and think are supported by the evidence, other things that we don't, and that will influence how we assess new evidence. So just a little bit of humility, I think, goes a long way.
Nicely said.
Yes, indeed. And that's certainly been the outcome in my world. It's like, it is, nothing's humbled me as much as skepticism. And I think I think people like confidence. You know, when you come in and have a confident answer, people tend to believe that confident answer. And my big takeaway is confidence is rarely warranted. You know, maybe a degree of confidence, or, you know, give some percentages there, but it's rare that I run into a mystery that I have 100% certitude about the solution, you know, so.
I suspect that you're like me. I like people who change their minds.
Oh, yes. Yes, exactly. Yes.
I mean, in certain spheres, like politics being the prime one, you just can't do that. It's political death. And that is ridiculous.
It is. We need a cultural shift towards understanding. Yeah. Like, yeah.
If the evidence changes, then change your mind. It's okay to say, well, I did think this. Now I think this. I've changed my mind on a lot of things over the years.
I'm proudly wearing the same underwear I grew up in. What?
Not exactly the same thing, but.
But I totally agree. Anyway, Chris, thank you so much for both writing this book and taking a few minutes to talk to us about these ideas.
Be my pleasure.
Yeah. Always a pleasure for us, too. Thank you.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Professor Chris French about his new book, The Science of Weird Shit. Links to his book will be in our show notes, and we hope you enjoy it. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening to our humble show.
Been a Monster House presentation.